Morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and we try to use the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us in KGNC. Thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. No big film this time, but I wanted to make a quick note of three films whose scenarios tie them to some of the darker corners of the real world. So here's a situation. A bridegroom has been possessed by the spirit of a young woman on the day of his wedding. As the celebration deteriorates into chaos following the absence of the happy couple, a teacher for the small town in which this is all taking place, a man who remembers this dead girl from his own youth, questions the ghost, finds out that all she wants is to return to her family. He replies gently that she can't because she has no family. A not uncommon scene for such a ghost story, except that the ghost is talking in Yiddish, the town is in Poland, and the teacher, as well as quite a few of the wedding guests, including the bride's father, are old enough that the talk of missing Jewish families can be freighted with special and especially grim significance. In the Polish film Demon, which opens in a couple of weeks, director Marcin Rona takes the trappings of the Exorcist scenario and unleashes it into a tale whose characters have struggled to convince themselves, foolishly, that the horrors of the Holocaust can be buried and forgotten. Rona brings a savage satire to the proceedings, showing a wedding banquet devolving into madness and decadence, and giving us a priest with a pathological aversion to matters of the spirit. Demon demonstrates how the power of denial, wielded en masse, can put the lie to humanity's pretensions toward nobility. As well, there's not much room for noble acts in the French film Neither Heaven Nor Earth, which opened a few weeks ago and hopefully will be getting to other outlets soon. A group of French soldiers stationed at an outpost watching over a small village in Afghanistan start disappearing one by one. Director Clément Cogitor uses the ambiguity of the situation. The disappearances are never explained, and it turns out even the Taliban are not safe from the vanishings, to parallel the tenuous nature of this ongoing war, and to cast a revealing light on the emotional toll inflicted on everyone trapped in this unfortunate conflict. Neither Heaven Nor Earth is an engaging, low-key fantasy, but it has a real-world impact. Director Robert Greene is also hoping for real-world impact with his quote-unquote documentary thriller, Kate Plays Christine. His conceit? Hire actress Caitlin Shield to reenact the true events leading up to and including the on-camera suicide of newscaster Christine Chubbuck in 1974, and document the actress's preparation for the role and the effect it has on her. Not a bad idea, if a somewhat exploitive one. Problem one is that not enough is known about why Chubbuck was driven to her act to lend it resonance. The woman, as portrayed in the film, was something of a cipher even to her loved ones. Problem two is the presumption that any of this would profoundly impact Scheel to begin with. Actors, good actors, professional actors, don't become basket cases just because the characters they're playing were ones. But that presumes that Greene and Scheel weren't pulling a fast one to begin with, settling on their narrative and its outcome, and then using actual interviews with Chubbuck's associates and medical experts, leavened with moody long shots and an ominous score, as trappings to drive their story to its foregone conclusion, which seems to be a ham-fisted indictment of the audience for its voyeurism. Which kind of cheesed me off. I mean, Greene, you're the one who brought us here. Even Hitchcock acknowledged his own complicity in indulging his audience's baser desires. Kate Plays Christine takes a genuine tragedy and deepens neither our insight into the act itself nor our understanding of why such horrors fascinate us. But if you want the real scary stuff, it's over at the Monster Channel, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can watch it by going to monsterchannel.tv on your computer or iOS device, or downloading the Monster Channel app on your Roku device. I'm going to take a break from my usual beat Trump harangue, although you should register to vote and get out there on Election Day and beat Trump, to do something more positive and urge you to go see Kubo and the Two Strings. The general tenor of my friends' Facebook posts have been, "Wow, I'm so glad I decided to see this film." One friend even thanked me for passionately advocating for the film. That's a rarity for me. More often it's, "Why, Dan, why?" Laika, as almost always, needs the support, so get yourselves out to see this film. It really is worth it. I'm Dan Persons. Thanks for listening. Beat Trump.
Okay, now, you know, he says, you know, moving away from beating Trump, I see that there's nothing mutually exclusive about going to see Kubo and the Two Strings, mm-hmm. and thinking, when I get out of this movie, I'll campaign to beat Trump. And, you know, it's like, you know, but when you go to see Kubo and the Two Strings, you will forget some of the horrible, horrible, horrible things that are in our universe today. Okay. And that person that was named, not Kubo, is indeed one of the things that we would all so much like to forget. gee, my headphones are barely working. But hey, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, vibrating 99.5 million times every second and ending up in a little box which goes into your ear. That's what radio is, folk. And I am so pleased and happy. I'm always pleased and happy when we have had Nora Jemison on the show. I don't think either she or I have any idea how many times you've been on this program. Not necessarily, you know,
five or six.
Maybe more. Count all the times the Altered Fluid shows.
Remember one in the morning or three in the morning or five in the morning.
No, those were five in the morning. No,
five in the morning was, I don't remember.
Yeah. Those were good shows, by the way, and I keep telling them, folk, you know, now that we've got this wonderful space downstairs where we do the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, more about which in a moment, that we could do one there in front of an audience. That, I think, would be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And then after everybody does their critiques, yes, I know, Eugene, they're crits. After people, you know, then we can have audience participation.
Well, we can talk to Altered Fluid and see what they want.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, I've mentioned it to them occasionally, separately. But Nora has been on this program since, I think your first time was not long after you
moved back to New York in 2007.
Okay.
And got back involved with the science fiction community here that same year. So,
okay, right. You were in Boston before that, right?
I was in Boston before that, and I don't think I did anything then, although I was coming back and forth to New York.
Do me a favor, a very unprofessional. Tap your mic for a moment. I want to. Okay, keep doing that until I say stop. Ah, okay, stop.
Got it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now I know which mic that is on the board.
Okay, so you can hear me now.
Now I had them all up.
Gotcha.
I just turned the others off.
Okay. All right.
Okay, I'm sorry. So you just moved back from Boston.
Yeah, I had moved here from Boston and joined Altered Fluid like a couple of years, like a year or two later.
Though. Altered Fluid is a writer's group.
Yes, yeah. I didn't join immediately. They didn't have an opening when I first got here. I think it was like a year and a half or something before I joined them. So it would have been 2008 or 9 when I started doing things.
And at that point, how much had you sold professionally?
Oh, not much.
Yeah. And that was sort of my point.
I did have an agent, but I had not sold a novel because the first novel that I wrote that was publishable was The Killing Moon. And as I've told folks in my blog, that was actually my first publishable novel. It's the one that got me my agent, but it did not sell first. And for a number of reasons that I have some suppositions about. But But then I was writing the book that became The 100,000 Kingdoms. That book had already been written once back when I was in grad school, but it was terrible. So I was rewriting that.
Clearly, book. It didn't end up that way.
Well, no, that book still is in the trunk and no one shall see it. It was terrible. And so I rewrote it entirely from scratch. And that is the book that became The 100,000 Kingdoms. I was probably working on that and writing short stories at the time that I joined Altered Fluid. So,
and that would have been when I met you, was as a part of that group.
Yep. Yeah.
At that time.
And I think the first time I met you was doing a group reading.
Yes.
With Altered Fluid.
Yeah.
At one of the 5 a.m. shows.
Right. So. And my point is, you've probably been on this program all told more than 10 times. I think that's fair.
I really don't know. I have the world's worst memory.
Let's put it this way. You've actually recorded at my house twice.
Was it twice?
Yes.
I have the worst memory. I have no idea. Okay. I'll take your word for it.
I do because one was when the Inheritance Trilogy was finally bound together as an omnibus. That was actually the last time you recorded there.
Right.
I guess I'm including also the Nursif readings, because you've done...
But the Nursif readings I don't think of as Hour of the Wolf.
Well, except I do broadcast them.
Oh, well, okay.
So as far as I'm concerned...
Well, then, yeah, counting that, it's definitely more than 10.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
You know, there's the Theodore Sturgeon tribute that you did with Noel Sturgeon and Samuel R. Delaney.
Right.
And that was a great evening. Oh, that was wonderful. Mm-hmm. Then you did a reading... just a little more than a year ago with Cherie Renee Thomas.
Right.
Who will be on this program starting at 3:30 in the morning by magic. Not live.
As a show of her own, you mean? Or?
No, an episode of Hour of the Wolf from 2006, in which our topic is the just recently passed horrifying death of Octavia Butler.
Mm.
We talk a lot about her. What's the word I'm looking for? A book that changed the genre totally, in my opinion, with Dark Matter, a century of speculative fiction from the African diaspora. Oh, I got the title right, I think, for a change.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long title.
So, yeah.
I call it
Dark
Matter. Mm-hmm. And then it's Dark Matter 2, even though it's actually called Rolling the Bones, but I call it Dark Matter 2. And it was a show she and I did together. And you see, I didn't want to go to... Okay, let me explain to the audience. Lister is on vacation this week and next, the wonderful Lister, who does Burn Baby Burn Clappers, which starts at 3 a.m. So I'm actually responsible for covering airtime till 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to be awake at 5. Even if I am, I won't actually be awake. Mm. So what we'll do is we'll do our show live until 3:30, giving us thereby 2 hours, which is, I consider, an ideal length for broadcasting. And then we'll put on that old program, which has some audio problems, but I've cleaned them up a bit.
Okay.
So why was... Okay, my point is, you've been here a long time. I remember sitting next to you at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art when the Nebula Awards.
Oh, yeah, that night.
Oh, my God. What
was
a tortuous.
Yeah, the owner of the facility was generous to allow that and to invite everyone there to have that event. But
it was, and it was going to be a big thing, but nobody had any idea how long they were going to draw that thing out. They had 2 hours of schmaltzing around until they got to the ceremony, and then you were up for short story.
Yeah.
Short
no,
story.
No, no.
Yes.
At the time, I was up for
zero.
No. I think that was for the novel. That was for the 100,000 Kingdoms. No?
Nope. That was one of your first nominations. between Heroes and Nebulas. I can look it up.
I don't. Yeah, I'm not going to remember.
I've got photographs to prove it.
All right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, what's the story you have with the
time? Non-zero probabilities.
Yes, and that was nominated for both the Hugo and the Nebula.
Yeah.
And this was the Nebulas.
Okay. All right.
And it was held down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this fellow science fiction writer who's talking about, you know, going to Cape Canaveral and talking about the launches. And they went on for 2 hours, and then they only have four awards.
Yeah.
And so, but then first they had other awards. They had the Bradbury Award and the Saturn Award and this award.
They've gotten a lot better about
And the short story was the last one.
Yeah.
The only people left in the room at that point was the owner, John Ordover.
Yeah.
Who will, by the way, be our guest next week,
because
John Order was, of course, the editor of all the Star Trek novels for Pocketbooks.
No, I didn't know that.
And, yeah, he actually has a place in the history of sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And next Thursday, by a coincidence, and this is technically Thursday, will be the 50th anniversary of the first broadcast of Star Trek.
Mm.
So it seems right to have John on.
Okay.
As the guest. And we'll be doing a Nursif that evening.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a long day for me.
Mm-hmm.
With writers who've put together an evening put together by Keith DeCandido, who's written more than his share, and David Mack and Stephen Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
About Stephen by Skype. I'm going to project him by Skype. And if Stephen doesn't have his wife, Tanarive Du. With him, I am going to be very upset because I've never met her, but I love her work.
I've met them both super briefly, but I talk to them all the time on Twitter and Facebook more than I've met them in person.
I see them there, but so that's the lineup. That's, by the way, a week from tomorrow night at 7 p.m. here at 388 Atlantic Avenue on the ground floor. Admission is free. Donations are cajoled, and a good time will be had by all. And the technical end of it, because it's on live stream, and we have to get Stephen and Tananarive on by Skype projecting it, is going to be horrible, because Terrence Taylor is a person who knows what he's doing. He's our technical director. And he's had a death in the family, so he will not be there.
So
it's going to be me.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I'm a good audio engineer.
Mm-hmm.
This is not audio. So we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
But all that. So we're at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, where before we were at the Brooklands Common. We held the readings, and John, John held a reception, and he would have shut down. Everybody left, but he kept it open for you because you were nominated.
But I couldn't. I felt like I couldn't.
Yeah, this is one of the ways that I remember that you're nominated for a short story, because it was the last item.
They didn't do novel last?
I'm sorry?
They didn't do novel last?
No, they start with novel, then novelette, then novella, then short story. The point being that at about, 10:30, 11 o'clock is when they finally got out, and the fellow who was going to open the envelope, please, for short story was, not totally with it. And he couldn't get the envelope open. Barbara and I have filmed this. We won't show it to anybody but you.
I don't particularly want to see it again.
It's etched in my mind. It was lovingly remembered with your finally just shouting out, just read it!
Well, it's gotten a lot better. I went to the Nebulas this past May in Chicago, and it was... I think the whole thing was in and out in an hour and a half or so.
No. So largely because of that one experience.
Really? Was what spurred them to get better about it? I thought it was just because they had John Hodgman as the announcer this year, and he did an awesome job.
Yeah,
it was fun. They had a
performance. But that's why they got him.
Ah, okay.
You see, that's why they streamlined the whole thing and learned to streamline it. Because they also, by the way, after the Nebulas, there's usually a very nice party. And people don't want that party to start at 11 p.m. They wanted to start at 9.
Yeah.
So they can all stand there with their actually very, very pretty statues. But the thing is, five novels up through the fifth season, five nominations for either a Nebula or a Hugo. Every book you've written, every novel you've written has been nominated.
Was the Kingdom of God? The Kingdom
Wasn't
of
it?
Gods? I don't think.
Well, let me. I keep threatening to go
to the tiny computer.
I had Wikipedia open and I closed the stupid thing.
Oh,
I don't know why, but
I don't think. And the Broken Kingdoms tended not to get because it came out in the same year, and the Broken Kingdoms.
Ah.
Yeah, the 100,000 Kingdoms and the Broken Kingdoms ended up effectively competing
canceling
against each other,
yeah.
and the same thing happened with. The Shadowed Sun because it came out a month after.
But almost every year you've had something up because if it wasn't a novel, it was a short story because you used to write those.
I mean the only short story I've ever been nominated for was Non-Zero Probabilities, but,
which is a wonderful story.
Thank you.
I still love it. I love some of your other stories, and I find it a sad thing that you have become such a brilliant, totally accepted, when I say totally, I mean except for people who don't count, or are only to nine. It's not about how far they can count, how far they're capable of it. I'm sorry, I'm like doing three things at once.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I will say, things are changing for me. Because of little life circumstance changes that have been happening, so I have time to write a lot more short stories soon.
In the last 2 weeks, because when I announced 2 weeks ago that you were going to be on... I said, I'm trying to remember who the guest was that I had. I said, N.K. Jemisin is going to be on the program in 2 weeks. She has written some of the most brilliant science fiction ever. She's been nominated all these many times, and she has yet to win. But when she's on the program 2 weeks from now, she's going to be the Hugo Award winner.
I was actually talking about the Patreon, but this, okay.
This was on the air on my show 2 weeks ago.
I believe you.
And here you are, the freaking Hugo Award winner.
Oh, well, thank you.
Or as the New York Times said, that your blog was... that the title of it was unrepeatable. I think we have a list of the seven words, and two of them were on that, which were...
That was my honest and open reaction.
Well, as
if you read my tweets from the moment that I found out, it was pretty much the same language.
And it's just like, all I have to say, it's about bleeping time.
Thank you. And I was actually talking about the
Non-Zero Probabilities was 2010.
Oh, okay.
By the way.
Yeah.
And then 2011, that was the Goodreads, which, it counts.
Oh, the
but
Goodreads
it wasn't
Reader's
the same.
Choice Award. Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. But then in 2012, 2013, and 2016, you were up for Nebulas. And so on and so forth. This isn't very well organized. Oh, I see. This brought me to the Hugo Awards rather than to the... N.K. Jemisin listings. Why is that? That's very weird.
I don't think I've updated my blog anyway, so...
Yeah, but this is Wikipedia.
Okay.
And it is supposed to be updated for you. In fact,
that's
you're the only person not allowed.
Yeah.
Just like I'm the only person...
Well, I'm glad I forget stuff all the time, so...
Yeah, but the point is... Well, and here we have, nice pictures and all that of all your book covers. So they are in order, the 100,000 kingdoms, the broken kingdoms, the kingdom of gods. Awakened Kingdom doesn't really count, does it?
It's a novella.
Yeah.
And it's actually like a smidge, like 1,000 words over 40,000 words. So technically it's a novel.
Oh, okay. Yeah, over 40,000 words
it
is.
But,
that's correct.
No, it shouldn't count, though, because it was really, it's fanfic. A fanfic that I wrote myself.
Your own fanfic,
Of my own stuff.
Yeah. I tell people, you know what? You can go and you can buy 100,000 Kingdoms or this or that. Mm. No, go out and get a book called The Inheritance Trilogy, plus one.
Well, you actually get different things with different versions of the book. If you buy the individual copies, you get a short story at the end of The Kingdom of Gods, which ties up a dangling plot thread from the Broken
Kingdom.
And
that's not in the Inheritance Trilogy?
It is not in the Omnibus.
Oh my God, I'm going to have to reread the whole thing. How terrible!
Yeah.
He said happily.
But if you get the Omnibus, you get the Awakened Kingdom novella, which is not in the individual copies. So
this is evil.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, the idea is to encourage you to buy as many books as possible.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So, you know, from what I understand, it was a good strategy. People actually did do that.
For me, it's a fine strategy. So, I'll contact Orbit Books or Hachette Books.
I mean, you can buy The Awakened Kingdom by itself.
Yes, actually.
But only as an ebook. So
that's okay.
And unfortunately, you can't get the short story, Not the End, in any form other than the back of the individual copy of The Kingdom of Gods.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, it's only in the U.S. version. The UK version didn't have it.
Really?
So, yeah, as I heard from some UK readers.
How many languages is that book in now?
Oh, The Inheritance Trilogy is in... I'm starting to lose track. Like 15 or 16?
Yeah.
Something to that effect, yeah.
Any idea of... Is there any way of knowing anything about numbers? How many people have read this stuff?
Oh, I have no idea.
There's no way of knowing, is there?
I mean, I could
international.
With some time to devote to it, I could pull together the number of book sales.
Well, you have an assistant now.
I have an assistant for 5 hours a week. So
you sound like one of those people who, who are on visiting nurse services who say, yes, I have somebody who comes in for 5 hours a week.
Well, I mean, it's mostly... The biggest problem I've had now that I've finally hired him, you know, aside from the fact that I don't think I can afford to hire him to do all the things I really need.
Yeah.
You know, I've really got to sit down now that the Patreon has happened and kind of just sort of hash out my finances a little better. But the biggest problem I have is that I don't know the best way to use him. Like, it takes as much time to explain how to do things as it does for me to just do things myself.
Have you spoken to other writers who live in New York who have assistants?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
To the two of them who will be reading for us in December?
I don't know what you mean.
Oh, Ellen and Delia.
Oh, them. Okay.
Have Randy Dawn.
Oh, okay. Yes, I had spoken to a number of writers.
And Randy
actually is
a fine writer herself. She's been on this program as a writer.
I'm
and
pretty
critic.
Pleased with my assistant now. It's
Suggesting somebody else, and she wouldn't have the time.
Mm.
I'm suggesting that they can help. You were saying you don't know how to best use your assistant.
I'm wondering that I am a hands-on, do-it-myselfer type of person.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to give up things.
Yeah.
Like, for example, you know, he and I are going to sit down this coming week, and I'm going to show him how to update a PHP backend on a website. Because I need that done, and he doesn't know how to do it, and so I'm going to have to teach him how to do it. And so that's time that I feel like, you know, I could just do it myself. But at the same time, if I really want to just sort of push these things off onto another person, I'm going to have to devote the time to training it. So, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it's hard for me to figure out the most efficient way to do things. And that's what you've got to do sometimes. You've got to do things less efficiently in the short term so that you can long term get better about that. So we'll see.
Yeah. It's just that, you know, I'm looking at the life difference. Last time I interviewed you, which isn't that long ago, just a little over a year ago, mm-hmm. you were working as a psychologist, not that far from here.
Mm-hmm. Officially I'm not licensed. I wasn't licensed.
So okay. I was a counselor. Career counselor.
Yeah.
You're a career counselor with a background in psychology. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
Yeah, with a university, with one of the local universities.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was working full time. Things have changed a lot in just the last three months.
And so. At that point, mm-hmm. you were generally unavailable and freaking out a bit because you had a job and you needed to turn in books on contract.
Yeah.
Now you have a Patreon, so you have many more bosses than you used to have.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all about the writing. It's all about the good stuff.
And I don't think of the Patreon folks as bosses.
Now we should say, that's just me talking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm
trying to be
super grateful
cute
for them.
On the radio.
Yeah,
know.
Well, no, I mean, it's just, you know, it's the patronage model.
Let's explain to listeners.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for folks who weren't familiar with Patreon.
Yeah.
Well, basically, it's a crowdsourcing site for artists, kind of like Kickstarter or another of those.
I have to do a Kickstarter, Patreon, or something for the reading series because I lose about $50 every reading.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, people don't realize that. Uh-huh. That comes out of my pocket.
Well, either Kickstarter, you have to meet your goal or you don't get anything.
Yeah, I know.
But a Patreon is just a sort of general support thing. It's a great idea for something like this. A lot of musicians use it. A lot of performers use it. So, you know, the basic idea is that it's meant to emulate the old, you know, ancient world patronage model for artists where, you know, way back in the days of togas and such, artists would, find one wealthy person who was willing to support them or maybe a couple of wealthy people who was willing to support them, and pay for their food and upkeep. And that person got first dibs on their art and in some cases got to dictate and control their art. The modern version of it is people each contribute like $1 or $5.
Yeah.
The majority of my patrons, I think like the largest contributing group is the $5 contributors. Something like 400 people are giving me $5 a month. And it's not a huge investment on their part. It's a choice of, you know, whether they have the salad for lunch or you know, something a little more, meaty,
as it were.
Yeah. And, so it's not a huge investment on their part and they feel like they can contribute to my lifestyle and upkeep and so forth. I asked for only something like $2,000 a month because that was going to be a pay cut, but that was enough that I could have survived. And last I checked, I'm making over $5,000 a month.
Whoa.
So I am super appreciative
of those
patrons.
Clocksworld does a lot of self-support on Patreon, I believe.
Do they? Okay.
I believe they do.
Oh,
and
okay.
More power to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's...
Yeah. I mean, well, they're not giving me money for
nothing. And if Lightspeed ever wants to change their model, no, never mind. I work for Lightspeed.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, for me...
I do the audio editing for Lightspeed podcast, and I'm the host. And I do get paid for that.
Mm.
I get paid barely more than I get paid at WBAI. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I'm a volunteer at WBAI. I get an honorarium.
Oh, well,
but it's a showcase. I love doing it. And as a result of my doing that, I've gotten to edit about 8 audiobooks, full length. I got to produce one by Jennifer Marie Brissett called Elysium, not Elysium, as I always say on the air. And I have my own, which I don't plug on the air much, called Chatting Science Fiction, available at Amazon.com and at iTunes. But you know what? You know what I'll tell people? Yeah, it's available at Amazon. It's available at Audible. It's available at iTunes. It's going to be available through WBAI if you subscribe to WBAI. So don't get it yet. Donate money to BAI, and we'll give you a free... If you give $100 to WBAI, we will give you an audiobook worth $19. That's, mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what it is. That's the model. And the mm-hmm. weird thing is, it often works.
Cool.
Do you feel good about that?
Mm-hmm. Well,
I just like having an audiobook of my own out there.
Oh, my gosh. All right.
I haven't talked about this on the air yet. I really haven't. Mm-hmm. I've got Le Guin. I've got Bradbury. I'm very proud of
it. Great interviews.
Ken Liu.
Yeah.
I never pronounce his name right. I should just use the American pronunciation. It's Ken Liu in American, but it's spelled L-I-U. So it's really...
I've had Chinese students for years. It's Liu.
Liu.
Yeah.
He said, well, when he says it, you go, oh, yeah, you can hear
that,
it.
That, yeah.
There's just a little thing mm-hmm. that my tongue mm-hmm. doesn't quite do well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I don't quite do well. Ken, I've been pronouncing your name wrong for years. You've never corrected me. He said, no, you've got the American pronunciation just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's a very good he's a very giving person that way.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to take phone calls. I haven't the slight... You know what? I've done something very stupid, and I had so much to do before I came here. You and I were both sort of in a rush coming... right up to 11 p.m. or so, I think. And my prop... Oh! I found it. I found my phone number.
Okay.
It's a Skype phone number.
Oh!
See, well, get this.
Uh-huh.
We don't have a working telephone except in the station manager's office.
Okay.
So how do people call in on the radio?
So
I bought myself, it's like $6 a month.
Right,
I bought
right,
myself
right.
a Skype phone number.
Okay.
So now I can log out. Nobody seems...
I thought you were using Google Voice.
Yes, for my phone.
Oh, but Google this is Voice works as well for stuff like that too, doesn't it?
Yes, but then I would be giving out my personal phone number.
Well, it's Google. Which you can get 92 of them if you want.
Well, yeah, actually, and I may very well do that. Actually, what I want to do is not Google Voice, but Duo.
I'm not familiar with that.
Ooh, yeah. Huh. Duo is the new thing. It's like Apple's face-to-face, only it's like one click. And then you have your contacts, and then you're doing face-to-face or voice-to-voice with no calling necessary or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's really invasive, which is, yes, it's Google. It's really invasive, but it works.
Well, yeah.
It works very well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
But for giving out a phone number on the air...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what I'm going to do. One of the reasons I'd like to take calls early is because that more people are listening early.
Okay.
And here's the deal. I have had the opportunity to interview you here any number of times, and we're moving from, you know, friend who writes great science fiction to awesome celebrity.
Come on,
haven't even mentioned the fact that you are currently the critic for the New York Times,
along with several dozen others. And I'm
no, you're the one. You're the one doing what I read.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
Right. Well, you're within the very small world of science fiction.
How small is that?
Pretty small still. Pretty small
compared to mainstream.
Yeah, or compared to just period.
Well, big books. What are the numbers on big books?
I don't know. You know,
in other words, if Stephen King sells a novel,
how many millions.
People will have
read? I have no idea. But his sales.
Okay,
are
Le Guin.
Millions,
Le Guin.
So, I don't know about her sales.
Yeah, I mean she doesn't sell the way Stephen King does. Alas.
Yeah, I think the only one.
More is the pity.
Yeah, I think the only person in our community that sells that well is probably George R. R. Martin. So,
At this time,
nowhere near his level. So.
No, but I'm not sure that George hasn't reached King territory on a book by book.
No, well, I mean,
on a book by book basis.
Since the TV show, possibly.
Oh yeah.
So
I mean, before that, not that many people read With Morning Comes Mistfall. Still, my favorite story that George ever wrote.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. People forget when George was a science fiction writer, when he lived in New York, in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
I knew him when. I knew that young. He's been on this show. Mm-hmm. Not in 30-something years, mm-hmm. but so long ago that Margot Adler was the host of the show. Mm-hmm. And Margot stopped being the host of Hour of the Wolf in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
So.
The year after I was born.
thank you for that. Yeah, I started working here in 67.
I was 1 year old.
There you go.
No, in 67, I was not even
you
thought
were,
of.
No, you were not a glint.
I was not a mote in anybody's
yeah.
eye.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. No, that's a Pornell title. I try to stay. Well, Larry Niven and Jerry Pornell. So. Mm. Off the air, I'll tell you something about that. You know what I'm going to do is in a minute. It takes so much to set up to come in here.
Mm-hmm.
So that I play most of the music I play off of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do have some songs with me on a thumb drive. I could play one of those mm-hmm. and get everything else set up. But what I wanted to say is by taking calls early,
mm-hmm.
I thought we would give more people an opportunity to talk to you. Last week, not long after winning the Hugo for Best Novel, which is... You know, these things are incremental. It's great to win for short story. Mm-hmm. I love short stories. That's my meat
mm-hmm.
when I'm dealing with radio, when I'm editing for Lightspeed
mm-hmm.
or whatever, editing mm-hmm. audio. I always have to say that. I'm not an editor. I'm an editor.
Mm-hmm.
Right after that, the New York Times, not... your section, not the book review section,
mm-hmm.
where you are the science fiction critic monthly?
Roughly every 6 weeks.
Oh, okay.
It's...
Yeah, I've been wondering because I haven't found the exact pattern.
I don't know what it is either, honestly, but it's basically every other month, largely because when they first started doing this, I still had the day job and the writing job, and I could not do anymore.
Yeah, and believe me, I have enough questions that I could just, you know, fill up the time that we have until 3:30 mm-hmm. with questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to give other people the opportunity
all right, let's
to ask it. Questions. So, so now I believe I know how to do it. assuming that my password is the one that I remember it to be. And we watch the little Skype thingy go round and round, and it worked.
Okay.
So,
mm-hmm.
I am going to ask you a question, but I'm also going to start giving out the phone number that people can call
okay.
to speak to N.K. Jemison,
right.
a.k.a. Nora.
Okay.
N-K-N-K-A, a.k.a.
Or Nora.
I can't even say it.
Just Nora.
It's Nora.
A.k.a. N-K. Or Nora.
Or Nora. Nora, yes.
That's simpler.
Nora works. And that telephone, I'll say it now.
Okay.
But I'm not going to answer it yet, people.
Okay.
But the number is an area code 718 number. 718-569-7737. Again, 718-569-7737. Yeah, that's my number, but you know what? I'm except while I'm on the air,
mm-hmm.
this number is never turned on.
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry. If you want to get in touch with me, email me,
mm-hmm.
tweet me, something like that. Tweet me nice. so, the thing that I was... Okay, yes, I now see how this works. The reviews thing,
mm-hmm.
that's a whole different ball of wax. And you get to review approximately, how many words do you get?
It's 1,350 words per roundup.
And you get
so
to do how many?
I do three or four books.
Yeah.
I think the only time I ever did three books was when... my deadline got moved up and I had to teach a week of Clarion in the middle of it, so I didn't have mm-hmm. enough time to do four books. But normally it's four books.
Yeah.
So.
It must be nigh impossible to choose.
No. I look at the Locus upcoming books for a given period of time.
Locus is a trade magazine of science fiction.
I check there. I check some of the catalogs for publishers. I look at the catalogs for some of the small presses that do science fiction and fantasy that I know of, because I want to try and include indie fiction, quote unquote. I even will sometimes take a look at what people are talking about in the self-published world, although it's hard to review those for the Times, because the Times' policy is that the book has to be available in general interest bookstores, i.e. brick and mortar bookstores.
Yeah.
It's difficult when, you know, you've got an author who only sells on Amazon. That's not enough.
So The Martian would not have qualified a while ago.
Wasn't that commercially published?
It became acknowledged and a hit.
Right.
It was initially just a blog.
I honestly don't know.
Sold it on Amazon.
Oh, okay.
And then it got picked up for hard copy.
Well, as I understand it, it depends on whether it's just on Amazon online, or if, for example, it was through 47 North, which is Amazon's imprint,
right,
and maybe was published in physical form that way and available in general interest bookstores. So I honestly don't know, and I probably shouldn't get into that.
And that's a whole thing, because now Amazon and Netflix, as they're getting into the movie business as well, they release movies into theaters for like one day just in order to be eligible for awards.
I don't know anything about
that. Yeah, there are minimums that a movie that may very well have been produced by Amazon, they've done a couple of decent films, as has Netflix, in order to get it into the consideration of the Academy, it has to have played in X many theaters for X many days.
So they
will do that for the minimum, and then put it online, like right after, the day after it has met that minimum requirement. So I suspect there's a similar kind of a thing going on with self-published books and things like audio books for the... I don't know how the audio awards deal with that either, but, you know, there's the thing. Mm-hmm. So... There was that, and this is a problem that almost all people I know, Greg Feely comes to mind, different people who are in the science fiction. He's a very good writer. He's a very good critic. Mm-hmm. He's got, I love to catch him in discussion at, like, ReaderCon outside the dealer's room talking about what the sex life of the parents for the Bennett family must be like, you know, not Elizabeth, but her parents, according to Jane Austen. By the way, just released on video, Love and Friendship, the latest Jane Austen movie, directed by Whit Stillman. Based on her novella, Lady Susan. And it's fun. It's good. If you're a Jane Austen fan, which I am, go see it. If you're a Whit Stillman fan with movies like Metropolitan, go see it. The man turns out like one film every 8 years. And this is his latest, and it's a never-before-filmed Jane Austen movie, and I loved it, so... I just thought I'd mention that because No Way Dan is reviewing that. People like that, when they review folk, they often have to review friends. People they know.
Like who?
Greg Feely had to review Harlan Ellison. People that they're likely to run into in hallways, and maybe they've shared... broken bread with them or something like that. Is that something that has yet happened to you?
I'm not allowed to review friends. So,
okay.
Yeah, we have a really deep discussion each time about, and it's frustrating because I'm friends with so many really good writers.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, but I'm not allowed to review anybody that I know too well.
Because that's one of the things in the science fiction community is that it is a community.
Yeah. I have to have a discussion for every book that I want to pick with my editor at the Times about how I know them and how I interacted with them. Like, I think the biggest problem I had was when I forgot that I had blurbed a novel of an author 5 years ago. And so when I wanted to review the novel... you know, I didn't think that I'd never met that author. I didn't think that I had any kind of connection with them. And then I receive their book and I open it up and lo and behold, there's my own quote looking at me from the teaser page. And so at that point I was like, oh crap. And I frantically emailed my editor and was like, apparently I do have a connection with this person. Is this okay? And he was like, no, it's 5 years ago. You don't remember it. You know, and obviously it's not affecting your ability to, the question is it going to affect my ability to be, objective and honest? And if I legit don't feel like I can be, there are some people who I have not met face to face, and I don't feel like I could because I know them and I interact with them all the time on Twitter and I like them and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a judgment call that they give me some leeway on, but it's also has to fit their conflict of interest policy. So
yeah.
I throw it at my editor. He tells me if it's okay, and then if he says it's okay. Then I go ahead.
Yeah.
Generally, I'm in.
So you don't have complete freedom. Oh, I saw this book. I'm going to review the latest Matt Kressel novel.
Well, yeah. Beyond
to name somebody who I know is a friend.
Yeah. Beyond the conflict of interest thing, I have pretty solid discretion. I choose what I want to review. I am trying to showcase science fiction and fantasy and a little bit of horror for what it is now, and keeping in mind that it's for the audience for the New York Times Book Review,
right?
Many of whom are whose idea of what science fiction is rooted in stereotypes from 1950.
And that's a whole other ball of wax, which you have helped change in the world because you have gone, you've done guest of honor speeches in places like Wisconsin or Melbourne, and you've talked in these places, and you have stirred the pot of some people who, you know, think Donald Trump is a lefty.
It's all Chip Delaney's prediction from his essay in Racism and Science Fiction.
Yeah, isn't it?
That, you know, when people of color hit a certain critical mass, basically, and basically become a financial threat, we would see a backlash. And lo and behold, like clockwork, that's what we've been seeing. So, you know, what it tells me is that we're doing better and that we are perceived as threatening to some people's ability to dominate and make a livelihood that I guess they feel that they're entitled to.
Well, it's all about entitlement, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the people who...
Privilege and entitlement.
The people who squawk the most are the ones who, frankly, are fairly mediocre writers, as far as I can tell. So,
at best.
Yeah, I mean, and so if they're feeling a sense of, you know, struggle to compete, it's because they weren't competitive in the first place. So, you know, that's on them. And, you know, that's their inability to wrestle with their own sense of security. I do think it's kind of telling that instead of trying to get better, they decide to attack people who they perceive to be taking what they should be getting.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's a whole other conversation to have.
Yeah, it but is. Yeah. I started, for the very first time ever, I started telling people on the air last week just a little bit of the background of what the puppies are. It's a topic I've never dealt with on the air and, frankly, don't see the need to.
I mean, what I said was pretty much it.
Yeah, I think so. And which is why I brought it up with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And still, you know, I gave that. Oh, there it is. Okay. Mm-hmm. You see, I think I made a mistake. I think the problem is, okay, I need to write the number down.
The number.
I think I oh, for the Skype phone number, yeah. Oh, because okay. I think that as long as I can see it on my phone here, mm-hmm. then anybody's trying to call is calling my phone,
okay.
which is muted, and not therefore getting in on the air.
Oh, okay.
Right? All right. So, because mm-hmm. I saw.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way you can take questions by chat?
There is, actually. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind if people wanted to direct tweet me or something, or write me an instant message on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I'm Jim Freund in either case, J-I-M-F-R-E-U-N-D. And if you want to...
I think on social media they have to be friended to you, though. I don't know how that works.
No, I get a request.
Oh,
if they're not friended, it's such and such is asking permission.
It doesn't go into the other Facebook mailbox?
No,
the other inbox?
I'm using Messenger.
Oh,
I'm using Facebook Messenger. Okay. Facebook is resolved to destroy the battery of your phone. And they have so many apps that do so many things. And Messenger... Gotcha. Actually, I mean, some of their apps are actually pretty well designed.
Mm. Okay.
And that's one that works. But also I'm on Twitter as Jim Freund, J-I-M-F-R-E-U-N-D.
Mm-hmm.
And people can direct tweet me or openly tweet me.
Mm-hmm.
And and as I say that, okay, and here's a message from... Okay, from a fellow who used to, who was my neighbor in Jackson Heights when I was a little kid. Okay. I mean 4 years old. He was he was my uncle's neighbor. I don't think he realizes I'm on the air at this moment. Do you, Frank Heller? I just now realized the station moved to within 12 blocks from where I lived for 30 years. That's kind of funny in a weird way. When did this happen? answer about a year ago, Frank. Good to hear from you, but I haven't heard from this guy in years and years. Worked at BAI and did a great show called Madman's Matinee, which began at midnight, and owned the WBAI Coke machine, which is now being sold by TechServe. The machine went from BAI to TechServe. TechServe is owned by all BAI people. People don't realize that. All three of them, Dick Domenis, David Lerner, and Mike Edel, all former ops people who in the early 70s I would go in, and there was this guy, two guys named Steve, and one of them was selling equipment... to let you make illegal phone calls, and the other one was selling equipment through which you could smoke things. And you can figure out which one was which. Okay. But if you watch the documentary called Steve Jobs and the Man in the Machine, both Woz and Jobs will admit to which was which. Anyhow, those guys were working around with those people that became TechServe, which is now just finally, they're retiring and TechServe is changing the kind of business they are. There is no more TechServe. They're selling off all their stuff.
Really?
It was the only, yes.
That's a shame. I've bought most of my last few Macs from them and gotten service repairs done there.
No longer.
Oh,
no
wow.
longer.
Oh, that's a shame.
They're selling all, and they got the old BAI Coke machine there, and that was auctioned last week. All their stuff is auctioned off just last week.
My father will be sad. I sent him to them whenever he had questions.
Yeah, because a lot of people want to be able to use a company for this stuff that isn't actually Apple, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess he is actually listening. Okay, so I'll deal with that later. What I need to do now is, now that I got the phone number off of there, I need to sign out again. This is so much more.
I can talk more about the reviews if you want while you're trying to figure it
please,
out.
Please, Nora. let me just tell people while I'm wasting all this time, though, that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Nora Jemisin, that's Jemisin, better known as N.K. Jemisin, who has always been a great writer, but now is an award-winning after all these years. This year's Hugo Award winner for Best Novel, and also the science fiction critic for the New York Times. I believe the second one in the history of the Times.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, you had told me about
Gerald
the first one.
There was Gerald Jonas, okay. Yeah. I alerted you to that, and I saw your post.
Yeah, yeah, I'll check out his stuff when I get it.
And I said, oh, my God, was that guy horrible? And then you posted this review that was actually rather good. It was I agreed with a lot of what he said. Let's put it that way. To me, that's good.
I'm sure there's people who think I'm horrible, too, so... I've gotten one or two complaints about my reviews.
The community as a whole were like, Gerald Jonas. But I read that review that you posted on Facebook, and I thought, wait a minute. If that came out today, I'd go, oh, gee, there's a good critic. And that's the thing. Is that with you at the Times, Nancy Hightower at the Washington Post, and I think for major media, if there's anybody else, I'm unaware of people who really know their bleep.
I don't know how frequently she does it. I've seen they do it. I've seen both Kay Tempest Bradford and Amal El-Motar with NPR.
But that's the blog, not on the air, I think.
I really don't know. I think of the blog. It's still NPR. It still gets lots of quotes.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, people do that and all that. But, I'm prejudiced. To me, NPR is, radio.
I think it's the cachet of it works the same whether you're on the web or the radio. So.
Fair enough. And they are both people I respect. I need to meet. When I met, say her name again.
Amal. Yeah,
El-Motar. Say her whole name. El-Motar. First of all, I've edited the audio of a few short stories she's written. She did one called Madeline. She a good writer. I love her stuff. But the way I met her was I was going to go to the Meet the Pros party like 2 years ago at ReaderCon. I love the Meet the Pros party there usually, where you get a sticker and you get to hand it out and people collect stickers, great icebreaker and all that. And my partner and I, we took a wrong turn, opened a door, and there was Ellen Kushner in a room full of people, mostly women, who were singing the kind of music that I always play on the air, Appalachian and English folk songs. And there was this one woman with this fabulous voice. And
I've never heard her sing.
You must.
Oh, okay.
She's not only does she have a really nice voice that is made for proper folk singing, traditional, like Matty Groves and Tamlin and, stuff that came from England and got trapped in Appalachia and then went back and forth in different versions where lords become, landowners and things like that. Not only did she have a good voice, but she knew different versions and where the lyrics were different. The outcome was always the same. Everybody dies in these songs. whether it's Barbara Allen or Barbry Allen, she ain't going to survive the song. You know that.
That's hilarious.
Anyway, she's a wonderful writer and good singer. And
Yeah, I know her writing. I didn't know. I mean, I actually even did a reading for Podcastle, I think. I did a reading for one of her stories called And Their Lips Rang with the Sun. Hmm. And it was just sort of delicious to read it.
She's got a beautiful sense of her ear.
Yeah.
And see this, and this.
But just reading it, like the, just the wrapping my mouth around the words was I had
so
not
no
done
great
a lot
surprise
of.
That this is somebody who can who knows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Folk songs.
I had not done a lot of reading before, but I enjoyed reading that story.
Yeah. So, I remember your comments when you discovered Sturgeon, which I helped.
Mm-hmm.
I helped you discover Sturgeon, I think.
I still have not read very much Sturgeon, so.
But there are few of those geezers that did a lot of good stuff, and Sturgeon was one of them. He wrote a gay story that was published in 1951 that is relevant and radical today, called The World Well Lost, and 1951, and... It would make puppies' tails curl, but he's one of the masters that they adore. So there, let me give out the phone number. See if this now works. 718-569-7759. Again, 718-569-7759 is a Skype phone number. And I can actually try it out in another way as well.
Okay.
Is I can call it.
All right.
And you were talking about reviewing and critiquing.
Oh.
New word, critiquing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had asked about how do I choose, and
yeah,
like
what
I said,
are you looking for? Because
I'm looking for new forthcoming books that are either getting a lot of buzz in the community or that I kind of feel like are potentially changing or reflective of what the community is like and what the community is interested in. Like I did a collection of short stories by Lena Crone, a Finnish writer whose work was really, really influential to, I would say, like weird fiction. And a lot of the sort of interstitial, slipstreamy, that side of the science fiction house. And I don't read a lot of that stuff, I have to admit. And I struggled with the Crone book simply because it was more more abstract than I was really ready for. But I've been learning a lot of new things in order to try and represent what, you know, the breadth of this community. So, you know, I'm going into areas that are deliberately not within my own comfort zone. And I struggle sometimes to review outside of that comfort zone, but, you know, I do it anyway. I also have been trying very hard to not focus primarily on fantasy because, again, that's my comfort zone, although my editor at the Times pointed out to me that I had done like mostly science fiction lately, so I've overcorrected a little too much, so I'm gonna have to let myself be a little more fantasy focused for a while.
Is that important? Because are they or are they not perhaps the same genre?
Well, it's all the same genre.
Yeah.
But I don't want
that's,
to privilege...
That's how I always see it.
Yeah, but I mean, I think of it as flavors of the same genre. And I don't want to... I don't want to preference or privilege any one over the other. I need to do a little bit more horror. And again, if the goal is to show the breadth of the community and the breadth of and the complexity and the coolness of what's out there... then, you know, there's a lot of good stuff out there from multiple sides of the house. And, you know, another thing I'm trying to make sure that I do is show the diversity of the community as well. And so I'm trying to make sure that I'm keeping my gender balance. I'm including multiple genders as much as I can. I'm trying to make sure that I am covering at least one woman in every critique, generally two. I'm generally including one writer of color in every critique set, sometimes more than one. And I'm focusing on the people who are getting buzz, the people who are sort of being acknowledged as the new hot coolness, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm sorry, it's just, you know, you say one thing, and mm-hmm. that, in my mind, is sparking five different questions. Oh, you're trying to include a person of color. Oh, you're trying to include a woman in each thing, and you've got four or five to do every 6 weeks. How hard is that? How diversified has the genre become?
It's not that hard. It really isn't that hard. You know, there.
And this is the answer I want to hear.
Yeah, well, I mean, women have been part of science fiction and fantasy from jump. You know, Mary Shelley.
All she did was start the genre.
But, right. Well, but yeah. Is that all?
And she had to do it anonymously initially.
Really?
It's only with the second edition that her name was put on it.
Hmm.
The book was published anonymously.
I did not know.
You know, and then later on, what was? Oh yes, I was just watching the beginning of the James Whale Frankenstein movie on Turner Classic Movies the other day, and it was said based on a novel by Mrs. Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Ouch.
That's 1931, folks. Uh-huh. Now that may have been tongue in cheek. I'm not sure about that, but that's right. Right. You watch the classic movie that is only very loosely based on the novel Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus, and ouch.
Well, so...
and Lee Brackett, who wrote some of the great science fiction. In novels, and also wrote minor screenplays like The Big Sleep with William Faulkner and a lot of John Ford films. And then she wrote a movie called The Empire Strikes Back. But she wrote a lot of great novels and stuff like that. But the name Lee, which she spelled L-E-I-G-H, is sort of not clearly a woman. And there were, and then you have the problem of the, not a problem that N.K. Jemisin has today.
Oh, you mean the use of obscuring initials? That still happens.
U.K. Le Guin was in Playboy magazine.
Right. That's still happening today. I'm not focusing on older stuff at all. It's always forthcoming books. But you said
women have always been a part of the genre, and indeed they have.
Right.
But they've been,
and people of color have always been part of the genre.
Nobody really knew until 2000.
No one was asking, so that was a huge issue.
I was asking, but I'm a lone voice.
Well, and there were people asking, but you know the mainstream of the genre simply did not pay attention to those questions and those voices that were asking. So. But, you know, we're discovering that, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote some stuff in the genre and didn't publish it within the genre, but it was science fiction and it's, you know, that was 1910s or so. You know, and so the thing is, I'm not going to simply cover the same territory that everybody else is covering. As far as I am concerned, my goal is to not show what's getting the hype and the marketing dollars. My goal is to show what people are actually reading. And so, you know, I'm involved in, you know, a bunch of different little communities, often quietly or without speaking. I'm involved in a bunch of different little communities on Facebook, on Tumblr, you know, various places within the genre. I go to readings at science fiction cons, and I pay attention to which authors are getting lots
and
to lots
readings
of...
in New York, like the KGB Fantastic Fiction series or the New York Review. I've seen you.
I do, as but I mean that's not where I'm getting my info from. Is
oh,
I
just had to plug me.
Okay, fine. But what
you
I meant
know
was,
me well enough, and ego and all that.
I understand.
Yes.
But what I was
they're
trying
there,
to do
Jim.
Was
yes.
was is go to is get a sense of what. The breadth of the genre is talking and whispering about. And so when I hear buzz, I'm not hearing buzz from simply looking at the bestseller list is what I'm saying. I'm trying to get it in grassroots to the degree that I can.
Yeah.
And you know, social media is surprisingly useful for that.
Yeah. But you see, I rely on friends. For example, mm-hmm. let's say that I was going to have, after the Star Trek reading next week,
mm-hmm.
that I was going to have a reading, let's say, the end of this month, mm-hmm. like September 27th.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say I had a reader by the name of N.K. Jemisin,
mm-hmm.
who's going to be there. And I decided to ask her directly,
mm-hmm.
who should read with you?
Mm-hmm.
And you named a person that I'm ashamed I've never heard of,
mm-hmm.
Kaya Shante Wilson. Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
Mm-hmm.
If not for you,
mm-hmm.
I would not know of Kaya Shante Wilson, mm-hmm. who I have since read. And it's like, how do I not know this person?
He came onto the scene relatively recently with, I believe, The Devil in America was the sort of one that got all the buzz talking about him from Tor.com.
Yeah, and now I'm dealing with his publicist, who's being more than
right.
hopeful.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's very sweet. He's very nice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You mean Kai. Yeah. Yes, I thought you were talking about
no,
the publicist.
No. His publicist is a woman. But no, Kai, after I spoke to you
it's,
and figured...
Yeah, it's 2
yes,
in the morning.
I want
my brain is not keeping up.
If
but,
only it's...
Yeah. It's 3. Oh, okay. Kai is someone who I would not be able to review for the Times because he's also in my writing group. But if
he's
not
an altered
for that,
fluid.
He's an altered fluid now.
See, I
so...
used to know everybody in altered fluid, but now I'm, we haven't done a thing together in a while.
Mm, okay. Well, we're constantly changing. I went on hiatus for a few years with Altered Fluid because I could not write short stories, and I had back-to-back novel deadlines for years.
Yeah,
so,
we need to explain to listeners the way that mm-hmm. most writers' groups work. Mm-hmm. There are only a very few that manage to critique other people's novels. For the most part,
yeah.
they are critiquing short stories.
Right. And so I've really only become active with Altered Fluid again in the last 2 or 3 months. So, but that said, in the meantime, while I was on hiatus, Kai joined Altered Fluid, and unfortunately that means I can't review his stuff or any of the members of Altered Fluid.
Right.
You know, because there's obviously a personal connection there, but, I can still, you know, read his stuff, enjoy it as a consumer and gush about it on my Twitter, which I do,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, tell you about him and that kind of thing.
Yeah. You can mention him on the air.
Yeah.
And you can
there
tell,
you go.
And you can tell somebody running a reading series, mm-hmm. oh, here's somebody you should know.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is that there are, this is for me outreach.
Mm.
For me, it's mm-hmm. asking people.
Mm-hmm. Asking people doesn't work for me because my circle of people is mostly New York area science fiction and fantasy writers. And I want to get a more broad set of people than that. You know, I don't want to just focus on the people who live here and who know each other and that kind of thing. I've got to find out who's that guy from Idaho that everybody's talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm making that up.
Yeah.
But if there was somebody from Idaho and everybody was like, he's awesome, I need to know how to find him. And so
Spuds,
that means,
I think they call him, yes.
which means I have to go beyond my immediate circle of people. So, and the only way that I can do that is by, like I said, social media has been super helpful. It keeps me from being too insular.
Do people come to you and at this point and say, hey, you're the New York Times critic?
Oh, all the time.
So
Too much.
Yeah. I was going to say, you probably need a slush pile reader just to determine.
No, the Times is the slush pile. I tell them, do not send things to me directly because I'm not supposed to receive things directly. And they prefer that.
Okay.
They very much prefer that. They, in fact, don't like for me to have too much contact with the author or the publicist or any of that stuff. And so this is also part of their conflict of interest policy. So, you know, you send stuff to the Times.
See, I used to be a slush pile reader for Galaxy magazine.
In
the olden days. You know, it's not that we would get a whole lot. Uh-huh. But in the 2 years that I worked for Jim Bain, uh-huh. who was the editor there, and Spider Robinson, who was the other person there, I think I found two stories. I pulled two stories out of the slush that they published. But that was in exchange for a bad hamburger every day.
Why a bad hamburger? Yikes.
In other words, they went to, Spider Robinson, Jim Bain, and I would go to McDonald's every day.
Oh, okay.
You know, and they paid my bill.
Gotcha.
And I went to Galaxy Magazine, and there were piles up the wall of manuscripts, and my job was to go through them and see if some of them weren't crap.
Okay.
And also to amuse Jim and Spider with some of the worst, what we called the super slush, which we would often Xerox and put on the wall.
Oh,
yikes. The wall of shame of bad writing. But it was my job to look through the great, you know, unsolicited manuscripts, stuff that came in without an agent attached, to see if there was anything. One time, accidentally, in that group was a manuscript by Joanna Russ. Accidentally. It was supposed to go directly to Bain, and Bain would just take anything Russ wrote and publish it. People think for some reason that Bain was this, like, right-wing, anti-feminist, whatever. He was Joanna Russ's, primary publisher and editor for quite a while, as far as the magazines were concerned. They got on well. She was wonderful going back when.
Right.
And I got my hands on it. And I would casually say, well, there's this woman here named Russ. And he said, oh, okay, you can just send that to copy. It's like, you're not going to read it. He said, what for? I said, typos. He said, typos? Joanna Russ? No.
Wow.
And this is before word processors.
Right. Wow. Okay.
So there was a time when the magazines had to, John Joseph Adams was the slush pile reader for the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, is how he got started. So there are people who read unsolicited gunk.
Right. Yeah, it's not like that with reviews.
In the hope.
It's not like that with reviews. With reviews, they're finished books, they're published books. So we assume at some point somebody pulled that out of the slush pile and decided to publish it.
Yeah.
The question is more they have to send a copy to the Times so that the Times can basically check to make sure that it meets their policies in terms of being available in general interest stores and so forth. And then
So you vet them before you review them.
I'm sorry?
You vet them. In other words, you make sure that their Times ready.
I don't do that.
Somebody before
the,
it gets
the Times
to you.
Does that.
Okay.
So, so I have nothing to do with whether a book gets sent to the Times and whether the book is considered eligible or reviewable for them or not. All I do is I send a list to my editor of, hey, I heard XYZ's books are coming out. Do you have a copy of that or can you get a copy of that for me? And then they send it to me. And generally anything that's showing up in like Locus forthcoming books or any of the catalogs that I'm pulling from is eligible. But I also try and sort of range a little beyond that too. Sometimes I ask about small press stuff. Generally they have no problem with that. Recently, I started asking about graphic novels. So with my next column, I'm going to be covering a graphic novel for the first time. I can't tell you which.
Isn't that like a first for the Times?
I don't know.
It might be.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Maybe not.
No, probably not. I'm sure that they must have covered, like Art Spiegelman stuff or something.
I think there may have been an article about Art Spiegelman, but I don't think necessarily a review of even Mouse or...
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yeah.
It's a good question.
And, ultimately, I'm focusing on things, like I said, that are getting talked about, that are influential and so forth. And in my opinion... some of the best fantasy that's being made these days is coming out through graphic novels. You know, I don't know if you've read Saga by, oh my God, why am I, it's 3 a.m, I can't remember names. That's helpful. Fiona Staples is the artist, and I can't remember the author's name, the writer's name. What is happening? But Saga's won bajillions of awards. And it's...
I'm sorry, who's the artist?
The artist is Fiona Staples, I believe, if I'm not confusing her with some other Fiona I know. Beautiful art.
Brian K. Vaughan.
Ah, thank you, Brian K. Vaughan. Also the author who wrote Why the Last Man, I believe. It's some of the best fantasy that I've ever read. And I've been following it pretty much religiously for the last few volumes. And it's, some of the best science fiction and fantasy that I've seen has been coming out through comics in the last few, and video games also. But I don't think they're going to let me review video games. Maybe one day.
That day will come, because I was shocked and alarmed to discover, now that there will be a generational thing here between you and I, that video games are now eligible for... Video game writers
are eligible to join SIFWA.
To join Science Fiction Writers of America and for Nebula Awards. Now, that to me, that Naomi Novik, for example, wrote Neverwinter Nights 2.
Oh, did she? I had no idea.
Absolutely.
Cool. Okay.
Naomi wrote... I don't play a lot of video games, but I have played a few. I've played more than my share. And going way back when, I played every interactive fiction game that was ever writ. In fact, help me, what's the company who put out Zork and all
that? I've never known that name.
The classic original text adventure games. They were eventually...
I never had a computer in
They were
days.
Eventually bought up by Electronic Arts. I was playing these on my Atari in 1980. But they were going on. Douglas Adams wrote two of them. He wrote Bureaucracy. He, of course, wrote a video game version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He did the code himself. He knew his stuff. He also later did some graphic games, including a science fictional Titanic, which he co-wrote with Terry Jones of Monty Python. So I've played in the day my share, and I occasionally... Now I'm not playing narrative games. Now I'm playing like city building games and the occasional RPG.
Yeah, I prefer narrative games, and there are some...
I played Dragon Age, and I've got to say, I was not... It didn't draw me in the way it should have.
I think Dragon Age 2 is probably one of the best written games out there.
Yeah, and I see the now first because one, I didn't care for the first one.
Well,
I didn't try
and that's understandable. The first one wasn't bad either. The first one was sort of genre breaking in its own way, but fairly standard. But I have had some transcendent experiences playing video games. I played...
And let me just mention, I bring this up because I was astonished to find out at interview before last that we did, that you come into the genre largely through video games.
I started out reading.
You start, okay.
Before I ever owned a video game
Maybe
console
it had
as
something
a kid.
To do with your becoming involved in fandom, or... something that's a connection with a Ms. Bradford that involved video games in Boston?
No, no idea what you mean.
I just slipstreamed into another universe, I think.
I don't think Tempest plays. I don't know. I could be wrong. Yeah, I really don't know. I play video games just for fun.
I thought it wasn't a major inspiration for what you partook, not what your writing is, but what you partook.
All media I consume is an inspiration. So anime, fan fiction, video games are certainly part of that. Yeah.
For Naomi Novik, just to finish that point. Naomi wrote video games, and she wrote a lot of fanfic that can't be discussed because they were, owned properties.
I guess.
Of other people, and now, of course, people are writing fanfic of her Temeraire books, and hopefully of
Uprooted.
Uprooted, absolutely, which was a Hugo nominee this year.
Mm-hmm. And a Nebula winner.
And good book.
Mm-hmm.
Good book. But yeah, she came. She has written. She's a professional video game writer. Her partner, her husband Charles R. Dye, who's also her partner, is I think was a programmer of video games.
Well, what I
he became
what
an
was...
internet billionaire.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay.
Yeah, he started Juno.com.
I'm not sure what that is.
Oh, it was a major startup in early days
of
free internet service and all that. And they're still around as like net zero.
Oh, okay. All right.
Big company. Yeah. He started it and he sold it.
Well, what
and they
I
have
was
a nice house.
Okay, all right. Well, what I was saying about video games though is that I have encountered some that were more transcendent than some books I've read. I've been playing a game called Journey lately by a tiny little company called That Game Company that didn't survive producing the game, sadly. It made the game and then went out of business. But beautiful little game. No dialogue. No writing. So none of those writers would be eligible for CIFWA, which I don't fully understand. But, I mean, it's one of the most emotional and heartbreaking experiences and beautiful experiences I've ever had. I love Shadow of the Colossus and the Ico series of games. All of that was amazing, too. So there's some really, really good stuff coming out in video games lately that's excellent world building, great characterization. You finish the game and you start crying. So, I think all of these new media need to, and they are influential upon science fiction and fantasy. A lot of the writers of my generation and the next generation coming are influenced as much by those as they are by the Golden Age writers, or more so than by the Golden Age writers. And I think all of that needs to be recognized.
Yeah. Ooh. I think, I'm listening to the show. I didn't think you'd use the when did the station move question while you're on the this is Frank.
He's still having that conversation.
I'm not getting through. This is a friend of mine who
That's
I haven't
hilarious.
Spoken to in 20 years.
Uh-huh.
A good friend, a great BAI producer.
Okay.
Used to work for National Lampoon, did the Radio Hour and all that. I mean, good guy. I don't have a messenger app, so this one, this works fine because it gets through to me. So that's the bottom line, Frank, but good to hear from you.
Okay.
But if you have anything to say to anybody that's relevant to the show, you can write me on Facebook or through Twitter. The Skype thing, I don't know why. I tried calling myself and it's
didn't
not
work.
Working. Yeah, very frustrating.
Well, are you
It
checking
worked last week.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, no.
Okay.
No, I have this up. If somebody should call me through Skype, you'll hear that little bloop, bloop, beep,
right.
when that somebody's trying to call you.
Right.
I will hear it, but I tried calling my own Skype number.
And it didn't work.
Last week I tried it out, and I got phone calls just fine. So I will have to work this out for the future. and I apologize, but but we only have like another 20 minutes to go.
Oh, really?
Can you imagine? I mean, you're welcome.
Do you want to do the reading? I don't know that we've got time for that at this point.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think the answer is no and yes.
I mean, maybe. I'm happy to do the reading. I just don't think we've got time.
Well, yeah. So, I'm on till 5.
Well, but yeah, it's the prologue of the 5th season is... Let me eyeball it.
It takes about 25 minutes, I think. Because
I do think if it's so. I've read it before. Yeah.
If it's the same thing that you did at Word, when you were there with Paula Bacigalupi.
Last year, yeah. I don't know. I'd say it would be probably like 20 minutes, 20 to 25 minutes. But yeah, I think you're
I'm right. fine with your doing that. And what I will do is I'll take the show that I was going to put on at 3:30, and I will start it silently at 3:30, and we will finish our show, and then we can fade into that other show.
That's up to you. Or did you want to continue doing like just Q&A type stuff?
I don't mind.
It's your show.
but you're the guest. I don't mind doing just Q&A. But what we need to do is tell people, if you haven't already done so, go thee out and purchase thee the 5th season by as in Nora, K. Jemisin, that's J-E-M-I-S-I-N, which I got wrong the first time you were on the show. First couple of times you were on the show, I did S-O-N. And then just out, the sequel, The Obelisk Gate, which... yeah, you're looking to see there's something excerptable.
I'm just trying to figure out, can I do half of the prologue? You know what? What I think is probably safest at this point, I would end up reading faster and making a lot of mistakes because I would be worried about the time.
Yeah, we can also record something separately.
Well, and it's on my website. People can go and read the sample chapters, first two chapters of the 5th season at nkjemisin.com.
There it is.
Yeah,
there it is.
Easy peasy.
And oh God, if you read those first two chapters, you're going to be buying the book. I don't have to tell you to do it, because it's the world building. Is so amazing.
Thank you.
It is so wonderful. This is what you and some of the other writers. The reason that listeners and other people should go out and seek writing, in my humble opinion, of people of color, of the word I hate to use, queers, and since queers destroy science fiction, I come from a generation where the word was a pejorative. The Q word. It was... And people saying that they've reclaimed it for me has never been enough. I talk about this on the air with Sam Miller all the time and Rick Bowes. And they're both good with it. And it's like, yeah, you didn't live in my neighborhood.
They can say that. I can't. And I use that term when basically it's relevant, you know, but for the most part, I haven't earned that.
Prefer the G word, the gay word.
The G word. Oh, well, okay.
Or there's a word that John Joseph Adams uses that I love, quilt bag.
Oh.
I don't remember what it even stands for. People have to look it up on Wikipedia or something, but it's like they found something.
Decided,
transsexual.
I've lost track of all of the
point is that you can, you know, and the LGBTQ sounds to me like a sandwich, you know, and it's just, you know, people can call themselves as they will. For me, it sticks in my throat. But at Lightspeed, we've done Women Destroy Science Fiction. Queers destroy science fiction, and people of color destroy science fiction, and of course there's also a fantasy and a horror element. You're in the people of color destroy fantasy coming up in December in Lightspeed.
I think what the word you're going for is marginalized groups. Because if you
I would have said diversified, but marginalized is more accurate.
Well, I mean, diverse can mean so many things, and it's the word diversity is kind of a doesn't make any sense anymore. It doesn't make any sense in and of itself. It's being used as a euphemism for what people really want
to
say.
You know, it had meaning to me when I started this. When I was on the air still 20 years ago.
Mm. Okay, it's still got meaning. It's too loosey-goosey, you know, and really what we're talking about is the people who have not been treated as at